Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners who follow money trails across the globe will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. How millionaires make money to avoid tax. Which countries' coffers have been plundered to leave populations in poverty, and what the world can do about it. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and we're celebrating. Not just because it's a new year either. Radio New Internationalist has just won an Australian-wide award, the 2007 Excellence in Spoken Word Programming Award from the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. So today, we're playing you the program that won it. It's called Taxing Matters. Now, if you think tax is boring, then stay tuned, because today's co-host, John Christensen, is just the man to prove it's not. He's been the economic advisor to the government of that infamous harbour of tax havens, Jersey, a position he held for 11 years. Now he's a director and founder of the Tax Justice Network, and he's about to take us through some pretty amazing financial facts. For instance, the Tax Justice Network estimated in 2005 that the amount of funds held by individuals in offshore tax havens is about 11.5 trillion US dollars. That means a worldwide tax revenue loss of around 255 billion US dollars. To put that in perspective, because it needs a bit of perspective, that means that world governments are missing out on tax revenue that amounts to the gross domestic product of countries like Hong Kong or Greece. Or, put another way, that's enough to plug the financing gap in achieving the United Nations Millennium Development Goal of halving world poverty by 2015. While tax havens might not be illegal, John, it certainly seems immoral. Tell us all how it works.
Look, the fact of the matter is that over the past half century, whilst we've been looking the other way, bankers, lawyers and accountants have been quietly building up what I call a parallel economy, a shadow economy, which consists of an offshore infrastructure of small islands and some very big financial centres, because it's not just small islands like Jersey. The City of London is an offshore finance centre and a tax haven. Luxembourg, Switzerland, Manhattan in New York is another offshore finance center. Gradually, they built up this parallel global economy, which is designed to meet the needs of the rich and the powerful people of this world, including the world's biggest companies. And they've been rather audaciously establishing themselves through offshore companies, offshore trusts, shell companies, where they pay less tax, in many cases, no tax at all. But they also avoid the regulation that we've been putting into place in the mainstream economies over the past half century. So to all intents and purposes, they've created a parallel economy and removed themselves from the economies in which most of us ordinary people operate.
John, can you take us through a specific example, a country or a person, for instance? What's your favourite?
I think my favourite is probably a fellow Australian of yours, actually, Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch, when he set up News International all those decades ago, he now operates around the world. He's very big in the United Kingdom, the United States, across Europe. His empire is pretty global. It's established through over 800 companies, which are almost impossible to investigate because most of these companies are set up in these very secretive jurisdictions where it is impossible to get any relevant or useful information about the companies and the trusts that are established in these small islands and in these tax haven jurisdictions. And that's the important thing to bear in mind. All of this happens in an atmosphere of total secrecy. So when we're trying to investigate these things, we come up against brick walls time and time again. We say, okay, who owns this company? And you discover it belongs on paper to the clerk working in a lawyer's office somewhere in Bermuda or the Bahamas or somewhere. And there's no way of finding out who's actually behind this company. Now, this doesn't just mean that people like Rupert Murdoch end up paying virtually no tax at all.
Well, in some cases, John, in some countries, none at all. The Murdoch empire pays none at all. For instance, I read that in Israel, that the empire was paying nothing.
That's right. And the same in Britain for many, many years. In fact, for over a decade, News International, which has its most profitable publications in Britain, paid no tax at all. Now, look, the trouble is that a lot of people think, well, that's great. I'd love to not pay any tax. That'd be marvelous, you know. The trouble is that there are lots of effects. First of all, it means that all of us think, well, the tax system is rigged, isn't it? So they pay no tax and we have to pay more. And that's true. It is happening. The more the wealthy people do this, the more middle-income and low-income people, including very poor people, have to pay tax, because politicians have been quietly adjusting to this new world by shifting the tax burden from the rich to the poor. And that doesn't just apply to Australia or the United Kingdom or to France. It applies to developing countries in particular, because it's developing countries in Africa that suffer worst from this problem.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Melbourne Community Radio Station 3CR, chatting with today's co-host, John Christensen from the Tax Justice Network.
Solo mi arte sublime yo adoraba, mi afán era tan solo sentir la nota que armoniosa me inspiraba, recordando que podía pensar en ti.
Let's go now to Amsterdam and link up with investigative journalist and author Nick Shackson. Nick's an oil in Africa expert, and Gabon, a country on Africa's west coast, has a story close to his heart. For decades, President Omar Bongo of Gabon guarded over a giant offshore slush fund fed by African oil and hooked up to tax havens. How did he manage to do that, Nick?
Well, it's extraordinary that so few people know about it. It seems to me this is probably the biggest secret in Africa for many, many years. And he managed to do it with extraordinary stealth. President Bongo was put in power effectively by the French government, by Charles de Gaulle, back in 1967, and he's been in power ever since. And he and the French government and French political parties and intelligence services set up an extraordinary system. One of the main purposes was to finance French political parties, but it was also used to finance the objectives, commercial and diplomatic objectives, of French companies and organizations around the world. And it was basically using Gabonese oil as a source of offshore money that could be then used to oil the wheels of whatever the French governments wanted to do. And in exchange for President Bongo's complicity in this giant scheme, French government sent hundreds of soldiers to Libreville to protect him. And this is an oil-based relationship that has endured for decades.
So tell us about the nature of that relationship. What type of relationships did the French want protected?
I guess the foundation of it was the financing of French political parties. Originally, it started off as the French right wing, and this was their sort of source of secret party financing. And when they needed money for something, they could get it secretly under the table through this extraordinarily complex offshore slush fund. It wasn't just Gabonese oil. It was Gabon was kind of hooked up to other countries in the region. Congolese oil and Angolan oil were all part of this incredibly complex mix. And there was a whole seething world of subterfuge going on out there. And probably to an extent today, there are elements of this system which are still in place. And it's kind of reminiscent of another subterranean world that people are kind of suspicious about, but don't really know the details of. An example of that would be the United States and Saudi Arabia, or Britain and Saudi Arabia, where we know there's something rather fishy going on, but we don't have the details. The difference with the Gabonese system is that from the mid-1990s, French investigating magistrates broke this system open, or they broke it partially open, and they exposed it. And for the first time, we were able to see the inside of one of these extraordinary transnational oil-based international relationships with giant corruption. And one of the key points about these systems is that they corrupt politics, not just in the producing countries in places like Africa, but they corrupt politics in the developing world as well. And,
yes.
And we're pretty blind to these systems. And this is an incredibly valuable set of circumstances, because we can see inside one of these systems by looking at the record that the French investigating magistrates brought up.
Well, I'd like to go into the actual practical political effects of this later on, Nick, further down the track. But just staying with Gabon and the facts of that situation for a moment, how much money we're talking about?
Well, it's very hard to know. The magistrates only broke open a certain amount of it. Gabonese oil at its peak in 97 was producing about 370,000 barrels a day, but you connect that with other nearby oil industries and you've got several hundred thousand barrels a day. Now, of course, some of this is going to finance Gabonese government objectives and African infrastructure and all that kind of stuff. But a certain percentage of it was being diverted, and it was going through international banks, and it was going through the City of London. And there was an investigation in the United States which discovered that Citibank had been facilitating huge flows of money on behalf of President Bongo himself that he used for his own purposes. The actual total figures have never really been nailed down exactly, but we're certainly talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
So we're talking also about some of the most influential and largest companies, not just banks, in the world. I mean, a Citigroup is the largest bank when I last looked at it in terms of profit. What other banks are we talking about?
There were a lot of French banks involved. There was a very strange Franco-Gabonese bank called the French Intercontinental Bank, FIBA, which was really the heart of the system. And this used all sorts of different tax havens like Luxembourg and the City of London, of course. And this all snaked around the world into Paris. There were all sorts of lesser players. FIBA was kind of the central player in this system. But of course, they have banking relationships with any number of other banks in Britain, America, France, and around the wider world.
I mean, one of the most offensive parts about this is that the United Nations estimates that between 60 to 70% of Gabonese are living on less than $1 per day. How come international financiers let Bongo get away with this booty?
How did the banks get away with it?
Well, no, I think what I'm asking is, like, it's so clearly immoral. Why do the international financiers allow it to happen? I mean, they must know through these trails what's going on.
In terms of this situation, it was very much a French system, and there was, in a sense, a conspiracy among the French elites to keep this whole thing quiet. If you were an insider in the elites, you knew about this system and you knew how it worked, and you were part of it, and it was in your interest to keep it quiet. So there was that level of political silence, which was only broken open by the magistrates. But I think more generally, there's a problem of international banking secrecy, which has come to be accepted around the world. And John would certainly be able to explain that in much better detail than I would.
Yes, indeed. John, perfect time for you to enter stage left. What is it about the culture of international finance that allows this immoral rip-off of countries to happen?
In 1985, I left Malaysia after investigating a major scam involving hundreds of millions of dollars of savings which had simply disappeared. I returned home to Jersey, that's Jersey Channel Islands in Europe, to look into this and to find out what drives these bankers, because they know what's going on. They help set up the networks. They set up the companies, they set up the accounts, they manage the accounts. The truth of the matter is they turn a blind eye to this because this is very profitable work indeed, and they know it. To give an example from West Africa, following on from Nick's example, when the Nigerian president, Sani Abacha, was in power, he was a dictator in the late 1990s, he had a standing order payment in place instructing the Central Bank of Nigeria to transfer $15 million a day I'm going to repeat that. $15 million a day out of the Central Bank of Nigeria to his private accounts in Switzerland. And that money then moved on into other accounts in London and in Jersey. And everybody who was handling that money knew where it came from and must have known it was stolen. Did anyone blow the whistle? Not a single person spoke out against it. Now, I was in Jersey at the time, and when the scandal blew open, the Jersey regulatory authorities made a big thing about, yes, they eventually returned the money. But the truth of the matter is that a lot of bankers in Jersey were aiding and abetting a crime of immense scale. Over $4.5 billion were stolen by Abacha and his family. Much of it ended up in Jersey. You know, not a single one of these fences, because these bankers were acting as fences, not a single one of them was ever prosecuted. And in fact, one of them now sits on the Jersey Financial Services Commission as a regulator.
Wow, that's incredible.
The guy should be in prison. Now, that's the trouble. We have a banking system which is beyond regulation, which knows full well what it is doing, but they hold the reins of power. And the problem is that here in the United Kingdom and in the United States, we have become so reliant upon money flowing out of Latin America and Africa to keep our economies going that our politicians turn a blind eye to the whole system.
And for Africa itself, this must be crushing. Nick, we were talking earlier in the program about how $255 billion is lost each year in potential taxes because of the type of corruption that you've both just been describing. What kind of loss is this for countries in Africa in practical terms?
There are various elements of the loss. One element is just the amount of money involved, and it flows out in many different ways. Another element is if you have elites in Africa effectively escaping the bonds of normal society, you have a corruption of the democratic process. When elites can take their money out, they don't need to worry about what happens at home, and they don't pay taxes because it's hidden in places like London and Switzerland. And then their bonds with their own societies become eroded and they operate in a sort of parallel world. And this is something I noticed very, very much on my travel in oil zones in Africa, and particularly in Gabon. It really did feel like you were on another planet when you entered into these worlds, when you started dealing with these people. Gabon, when I first went there and I managed to get connection through a connection in Paris into a presidential circle, it really felt like Alice in Wonderland. Everything was on its head, whereas in the rest of Africa there's huge poverty and things don't work and power cuts and stuff. This place was tightly controlled, but also very highly polished, humming machine, and everything worked and people would turn up to meetings on time and everybody was expecting you and polite and charming, and it was completely divorced from the other side of the country. And lots of people in these countries, and neighbouring Congo Brazzaville as well, of course, where the poverty has been much worse and where there's been a lot of war, people were very, very strongly on the street, very aware of this double world. And you find this in all of these countries up and down the coastline, a sort of divorce between what the elites are doing, what's happening in the rest of the country, and you get these sort of enclaves.
I'm wondering, everybody around Bongo, were they all on the take as well, Nick? Because they must have known what was going on and they must have supported it.
Yes, it becomes a way of life, a way of doing politics. Politics in Africa tends to happen in very different ways to how it does in the West, and they would say, well, how can you judge us on the way that we behave? But the ordinary citizens are the ones who lose out. And yes, there is a certain truth to the idea that corruption isn't perceived in the same way in Africa in many cases than it is in Europe. But the fact is, the effects are always the same. It has the effect of making the rich and powerful much richer and more powerful, and making poor people much poorer and even more subservient than they would have been in the first place without all this money draining out of the country.
Crushing to democracy. I mean, it strikes me that Africa has the fastest growth of millionaires in the world and they're mostly untaxed. Why are African countries relying on aid rather than taxing those who profit most from their countries, Nick?
Chris, can I just chip in at this stage?
Absolutely.
A couple of figures which I think will be of great interest. First of all, the African Union in 2004 provided an estimate of the total outflow of capital from Africa annually at just short of $150 billion a year. That's $150 billion of Africa's financial wealth flows out of Africa, and the vast majority of it, over 80%, never goes back.
That's a shocking figure.
Compare that Now, yeah, but compare that figure with the aid figure, which is currently about $30 billion a year flowing into Africa. You have a ratio of 1 to 5, and we reckon that these figures are quite conservative. We think that for every dollar of aid that flows into Africa, $5 of financial assets flows out south to north, heading into private bank accounts. And the overall conclusion, not just of the Tax Justice Network, but also of many other researchers, is that Africa, in fact, holds more assets outside Africa than its total debt.
Wow.
But the problem here is that the assets are being held by private individuals like Bongo and all of his cronies, and the debt is held by the public, the general public in Africa, and they're having to pay for this debt and servicing the debt through the tax system. I'm not arguing that aid is a bad thing. I'm just saying that aid is not being effective. And if we really want to help Africa, the starting point must be to stop these massive capital outflows and to tackle the huge tax evasion that Africa suffers from. I mean, I'll give you an example. Kenya, which everybody knows, is one of the more advanced African countries in terms of its governance. Kenya reckons that about half its annual tax revenues is outstanding due to tax evasion. Half.
The question that arises on those fantastic figures that you've just given us, John, and this is a question to both of you, is that what we're talking about with aid is reliance, sometimes crippling conditionalities imposed by world banks on political and economic systems within Africa, whereas what John has just indicated is that countries could stand on their own two feet and say to the rest of the world, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the institutions of the West, we're not going to take your aid, we're going to be self-sufficient, and we're going to do it our own way. It seems to me amazing that countries are prepared to go with the aid option rather than that latter form. So I'd love both of your comments about this. Nick, would you like to bat in first?
Yes. I call it a giant blind spot in the entire development debate. I think just now, with work of people like John, this is starting to change. But in the past, there have been several reasons why we have had this blind spot. One is that it's the issue of tax, which is so important here. It's the issue of being able to tax capital flight. But the problem with tax is that nobody in the development debate really wants to think about it. A, because it seems rather arcane and remote, but also because if countries rely on their own tax revenues, then perhaps it means they've got less need for the aid industry. And of course, there are interests in the aid industry who want to keep the aid business going. That's perhaps overly cynical.
Sorry, Dick, can I just interrupt there? I mean, you really think that some of the major aid organisations internationally, the NGOs, would actually prefer to see their system in place rather than self-reliant Africa?
I wouldn't put it quite like that. I'd say that there's a laziness. People are much happier looking at what they're doing and how they can keep the way they do things rolling and not to really think hard enough about what all this means. And I think this is something we need to question. I wouldn't put it as cynical terms as you have just said.
I'm wondering if there's a reason why you think that. Is there an example you can give us that actually has provoked you to actually think along those lines?
When you work in these countries, I have for the last 15 years or so researched these countries, you meet people in the aid industry all the time, and people compartmentalize. They look at their narrow projects and they don't think about wider impacts of what they do. And I see that everywhere. People just looking on the ground ahead of them and not seeing the wood for the trees. But also, on the other hand, if you go back to home governments, donor governments, then if you take a country like Britain, for example, then you do start to get a little bit more cynical because there are obviously vested interests involved in having a system where you allow huge inflows of money into your rich country flowing out of places like Africa, and you put a plaster on the wound by dribbling a little bit of that money back in the form of aid. Also, other reasons, I think civil society around the globe hasn't properly understood the impacts as a result of financial liberalization around the world in recent years and decades. And I think we're just beginning to start to understand some of the most fundamental problems here. Mm. And that's some work John's doing.
I can bear out what you said about the British government. The British government's Department for International Development has been resolutely turning a blind eye to this matter for years, as far as I'm concerned, because I've been talking to officials from that department for well over 20 years. And I can see in their eyes, they just wish I'd go away. They just wish we didn't exist. You know, this is not an issue they want to tackle because they know that the UK government does not want to do anything about this. And I'm going to be very blunt about this. The UK government has decided it will not do anything about this. And we're going to have to force them to do something about this. Just also to bear out what Nick was saying there, Chris, in 2003, I and a colleague, Richard Murphy, who's a very senior chartered accountant and an economist, went to Geneva to attend the annual meeting of an obscure group called the Ad Hoc Group of Experts on International Cooperation in Tax Matters. This is a United Nations group, which in 2004 turned into a committee. And this is the committee that should be addressing capital flight and tax haven issues at a global level. We were the first civil society representatives ever to attend any of their meetings in 30 years. And that's important, because on the other side, the International Chamber of Commerce was there in strength, represented by Swiss bankers and lawyers. And they were there to make damn sure this committee does nothing and achieves nothing. But if we are to do anything, that is, if civil society is to tackle this issue, we really have to start paying attention to what happens in these obscure, arcane, and hellishly boring committees. And we're going to have to start kicking these committees into shape and shaping their agenda and saying, it is time you started paying attention to the bigger picture issues rather than just arguing about how many angels can sit in the heads of a particular clause.
Yes. I think one of the problems probably is, too, that tax issues are very complicated, that the best minds of the financial world are constantly at play to actually keep up with the game and change the rules, and that if you are a member of an NGO and with limited resources and certainly not good access to corporate lawyers, then it's very difficult, I think, for civil society to keep up with the game here and actually explain itself in a public forum without landing egg on its face.
Absolutely.
You know what? I've got some good news for you here, which is that the world has moved on. The internet has helped us and Skype helps us. The network that we've created, the Tax Justice Network, is modeled on the idea, okay, the NGOs don't have this expertise, we'll provide it with them. So we've collected this group of real world experts in this area, and they've been working away in their various universities or different departments around the world. They've been looking for civil society support for a long time. Our model is, let's put these people at the disposal of the NGO community. So we're now working with, for example, in the United Kingdom, with Christian Aid and its equivalents across Europe and in America and in Australia and in Africa, and we're able to feed through to them top-class lawyers, top-class chartered accountants, top-class economists who understand the issues. So we've turned the model around to the advantage of the NGOs, which means the NGOs can go into the negotiating committees and so on, armed with world-class expertise.
That's a fabulous resource, John. And I'm wondering, Nick, what was your view?
I absolutely agree with what John's saying. I mean, I would say we are at the very, very beginning of a very long process. And I think that, to me, the Tax Justice Network is the most extraordinary non-governmental network I think I've ever come across. When I was writing my book, Poisoned Wells, about oil in Africa, John Christensen rang me up and he said, have you thought about these issues? And I had been coming across tax havens again and again in my work in oil in Africa, but I'd never really been able to look at them in a coherent way. And suddenly, as I was speaking to him on the phone and in a subsequent interview I had with him in London, all these things began to fit into place. It was literally like a light going on. I could suddenly see what needed to be done. And I think there's an awful lot of lights to be switched on. And I think in many people's cases, it's going to be relatively easy because people are ready for this. I think this is something that is going to build up a very large head of steam very soon. This is an issue that's really going to catch fire in the next few years. And I don't think we're going to see major victories anytime soon. But I think over time, this will happen. I think there is going to be a sea change as people wake up to what's going on.
Because the other issue for the international civil society movement is that what you've been describing today fundamentally affects democracy. If you have a system that props up corruption within countries, then it's completely undermining of any ability of a country to stand up democratically. I'm wondering what you both think of that.
Yes, absolutely.
Shall I chip in first with a couple of thoughts about this?
John Christensen, I'd love you to.
Nick is quite right. The debate is picking up in the United Kingdom, in Europe, and in America. And we're seeing some very lively discussions in the pre-presidential election in the United States, as quite a number of candidates are actually talking about tax havens very openly. In the case of Barack Obama, for example, he has signed up to the Stop Tax Haven Abuse Bill, saying these tax havens are costing the American public billions of revenue. And it was interesting that one of the first newspaper articles I read about that bridge collapse in Missouri directly linked it to tax cuts and said the governor of Missouri is responsible for this because he has been continually cutting taxes. What I think is happening publicly is a general recognition that the tax burden has been shifted from being a progressive system which taxes the rich at a higher rate than others. It's now been reversed in some countries, and Brazil is a case in point. The lowest 10% of the population are actually more heavily taxed than the highest 10%, and this is extraordinary.
Sorry, John, can I just interrupt there and ask, do you mean in the actual amount of money, or do you mean actually in percentage terms?
I mean proportionally. I don't mean the actual amount of money they're paying. I mean proportionally. And we're seeing similar things happen elsewhere. And the United Kingdom's tax system 20 years ago was quite progressive, and that progressiveness has now more or less disappeared. We now have what's called a proportional tax regime. So it's more or less equal right the way across the band. But what is clear is the top 1% are virtually out of the tax bracket. Their effective tax rate, the amount they pay, is far, far lower because they're able to use these very expensive offshore systems for reducing their tax bill. What this does is, first of all, it undermines our confidence in the integrity of the laws. We understand there's one law for them and another law for the majority of us ordinary people. But it also means that most of us now, and I put myself in this bracket, I think that behind the scenes, political parties are being bought by wealthy people whose interest is to make sure they don't pay tax or cut their tax bills as much as possible. And that undermines democracy. And the other thing is, increasingly, politicians are saying, we can't do this because if we do this, this business is going to leave this country and go elsewhere. So the politicians are telling us, well, we're no longer in control here because actually companies are blackmailing us and preventing us from doing things. And I think this also has an impact upon democracy. It is quite clear that democracy, and I live very close to the center where parliamentary democracy started here in Britain, it was always about controlling the tax system. I think we now have a sense in many countries that people no longer can control the tax system because companies are blackmailing our politicians and saying, if you don't give us what we want, if you don't make our tax regime more tax competitive, as they keep saying, we're going to shift somewhere else where we can buy a more competitive tax regime.
That's changing.
And the answer to this is, one of the key answers to this is international cooperation, and national governments have tended to view things very much on a domestic level. And cooperation is really one of the key planks of a route forward. Another thing I would say about what John has been saying, I see it in terms of an outflow and an inflow problem. It's relatively easy to persuade Americans to be angry about tax havens that drain the American treasury of money. It's much harder to persuade them or the inhabitants of any other tax haven like Great Britain of the perils of inflows when their own country is a tax haven. And that's one of the things that most people don't realize, is that both the United States and Great Britain are two of the most important tax havens in the world. The IMF recently published a working paper saying that the United Kingdom is a tax haven. Because of this problem of outflows and inflows, it's easy to get people worried about outflows of money from their countries, but less easy to get them to worry about the problem of inflows from places like Africa. This is why we need to link up so many different fields. We need to get people in poor countries interested in these issues and start banging the table about these money flowing into rich countries, as well as people in rich countries. So it needs to be a kind of global response to this problem, and civil society needs to engage very much on a global level.
And what are you finding is the response from the United Nations and the international community? John, what about you first?
Well, first of all, within the United Nations, they are building up to a major global summit in 2008 to review what's called the Monterrey Consensus on Financing for Development. Now, this was signed up in Monterrey in 2002, and the idea was to shift the development focus towards mobilizing countries' own resources. Now, that means, above all, tackling this issue of capital flight and tax evasion. Nick said earlier on we're pushing against an open door, and it's true. When I speak to the United Nations in Geneva just a few weeks ago, talking with them about this, they are really keen to have this issue tackled. The problem is the lack of political will amongst their member states. Time and time again, I come across very high-level officials who just love the pressure the Tax Justice Network is bringing to bear. But they say the trouble is, within the negotiating chambers, the powerful countries like America and Britain and Switzerland and others are preventing us from making progress. Now, next year, there's going to be a world summit in Doha in the Middle East to review progress. And the truth of the matter is there's very little progress that can be seen as a success story at this stage. And we, that is the Tax Justice Network, are now working with some of the leading countries, and that includes countries like Norway, Spain, Germany, Brazil, Chile, Algeria, and quite a number of developing countries. We're now working to put together a global coalition that will tackle these issues. And I'm delighted to say that Norway, the Norwegian government, has already committed to setting up a task force within this leading group process to address the issues of capital flight and tax evasion. So we are beginning to see the start of a global coalition, a political coalition, which is directly going to tackle this.
Can I just add something?
Yes, please.
John was talking about Norway taking quite a leading role in this. One of the things Norway is also getting involved is persuading the World Bank to measure this phenomenon. Now, the American economist Paul Krugman has commented on the blind spots that exist in economics. And these blind spots, he said, are the result of economists not wanting to look at things that they cannot put into their models. One of the problems with tax havens is that the information is secret. That's one of the definitions of a tax haven, is that it protects information, and this secrecy means that economists can't get hold of the information and they can't put it into their models. And this is one of the reasons for the blind spots. And it's fundamentally important now that we start to properly be able to measure what's going on. And the Tax Justice Network has put out some information and challenged the World Bank and others to come forward with their own data, and there's been silence so far, but it's urgent to put pressure on these bodies to properly measure this phenomenon, and then we can start really getting to grips with what we're dealing with.
That was Nicholas Shackson, African oil expert and author of the recently released book Poison Wells, The Dirty Politics of African Oil. Thank you so much for coming onto the program today, Nick. That was just fascinating stuff. Very, very interesting.
Thank you.
Bye for now. Listening to Radio New Internationalist, being broadcast through radios, computers, and iPods throughout the world, like the one you're listening to now. I'm Chris Richards, and we're chatting today with John Christensen, who's now a campaigner for taxing profiteers, but in a previous life has been an economic advisor to the government of that infamous harbour of tax havens, Jersey. You held that position for 11 years, John. You would have got a good look at what politicians think about the pros and cons of tax havens. What are your observations about that?
Truth of the matter is that Jersey was going through a very important transition in the 1980s and the 1990s when I was there. It was moving from being an island that had a strong tourism industry, a horticultural and agricultural industry. It had some light manufacturing, and it was being captured and taken over as a tax haven by bankers and lawyers. And this transition was happening whilst I was an economic advisor there. Jersey's a very small island, and some of the politicians, to put it bluntly, were well out of their depth. So they, as far as they were concerned, many of them, to to be frank, were making quite a lot of money out of this process. Some of them have been appointed as directors on the boards of some of the big banks operating in Jersey. So, for example, the head of the Jersey's Finance and Economics Committee, the equivalent to Minister of Finance, he sat on the board of Barclays Bank. And he had no experience of banking, no track record. What on earth was he doing sitting on the board of the bank? Well, we all know, of course, that he was there because he could do them political favours. So there was a lot of that going on. This is how small island tax havens actually operate in practice. I describe the whole culture there as the culture of the three monkeys. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Because if you do, you're very, very bluntly told there's a boat in the morning, which is a Jersey expression mean if you don't like it, get the hell out of it.
Yes.
And there was a lot of pressure upon some of the people, including myself, but I was very high up. I was a very senior civil servant. They couldn't get rid of me. And I eventually resigned because I thought, well, I don't want to spend the rest of my life doing this.
And now you're an international dissident, a prominent international dissident, and you're dealing with governments and politicians around the world. I'm wondering what feedback you're getting from them about whether or not they are motivated to do anything about it, and if they're not, what the blockers are on that.
Okay, that's a very good question. I mean, I think a lot of politicians around the world and civil servants and senior academics and so on who really, really, really want this issue to move center stage. So there's a lot of people out there with tremendous goodwill on this subject. What are the blockages on it? Well, I mean, the biggest block of all, I regret to say, is the President Bush administration in the United States. In 2001, one of the first things his Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill did was to simply pull the plug on the OECD's initiative to tackle harmful tax competition. And in that one move, they simply stopped one of the world's principal initiatives to tackle this. There you have, in Paris, an OECD team of technocratic specialists, first class in that subject, who were doing something about it. They had some support from the Clinton administration, and the Bush administration pulled the plug. So, I mean,
why would they do that, John? I mean, why? What would motivate them to do something like that?
Quite simple. I would be very blunt about this. The Bush administration is payrolled by very big multinational corporations, including banks and oil companies, and it was not in their interests, and it still is not in their interests to start paying taxes in the countries where they make their profits. They will do everything to stop themselves from paying taxes anywhere, and they are amongst the biggest users of tax havens like Jersey. So that's been the key driver behind the resistance to this process.
Greg Muttert has just dropped in from Platform, a London-based NGO which has been tracing the huge footprints that oil and gas leave in communities across the globe. He's been working in Iraq recently where, as we heard in our last program, the oil law on the table there at the moment will hand over management and control of Iraq's oil fields to international oil transnationals. In his travels, Greg's come across an organisation that I've never heard of, the International Tax and Investment Centre. What are they up to in Iraq, Greg?
Well, the International Tax and Investment Centre is really the mouthpiece of the oil companies in Iraq. Of course, as we all know, the major decisions about Iraq's future are being made under a veneer of sovereignty of an Iraqi government, but in reality, most of the major decisions come out of the US embassy. Now, the actual input of what the major oil companies of the world want has come through this lobbying organization, the International Tax and Investment Center. For the most part, the framework of what they want in Iraq, which right now is being codified in an oil law, the multinational oil companies all want the same thing. So six of them clubbed together, and they funded this organization, ITIC, to put their view in favor of a type of long-term contract called production sharing agreements.
So it's not just in Iraq they're operating either, Greg, is it? They're using this particular organization as a lobbying organization and tool in a vast array of other countries too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they really started out in the early 90s when they saw an opportunity in the countries of the former Soviet Union to reshape the economies and legal regimes of those countries in favour of big corporate investors. Now, when I interviewed the head of ITIC for a recent book I contributed to, what he told me was that what they did in Russia and Kazakhstan was really the model that inspired them for their work on Iraq. They saw a country going through a rapid period of change and an opportunity for them to go in and represent the views of big business. And so they had a lot of success in actually writing the blueprint for a lot of the tax legislation in Russia, in Kazakhstan, in Azerbaijan, and also a lot of the legislation about oil contracts as well. So that's what they're trying to reproduce now in Iraq.
So what type of oil concessions are they looking for in Kazakhstan and in other countries, Greg?
What the ITIC has pushed for is a type of long-term contract called a production sharing agreement. What these type of contracts do is they give exclusive control over an oil field to a multinational company or a group of them, the likes of Exxon, BP and Shell. And they very commonly effectively immunize those companies from not only any policy decision-making, such as on economic policy by governments, but even from regulation and legislation that affects their operations. So they're effectively a mechanism to ensure a flow of large amounts of profits into the coffers of these companies and make sure those profits are guaranteed against any change in law, whether that's environmental law, human rights law, labour law, and so on.
But there's a sovereignty issue there too, isn't there? I mean, virtually what you just described is countries ceding off parts of their country to the full control of oil multinationals.
It's precisely about sovereignty. What you're looking at, especially when you look at a country like Iraq, Iraq is absolutely dependent on oil revenue. Oil accounts for 95% of government income. And what's being proposed here by the ITIC, by the oil companies, and by the Americans and the Brits, is giving control over decision-making over Iraq's most vital natural resource to foreign companies and depriving governments from being able to make these decisions. That basically makes it impossible for them even to run their economy.
So, in terms of funding, what does the International Tax and Investment Center get, Greg? Do we know?
Their income's about $2.5-3 million a year.
And how many people would they employ on that?
I'd say probably about 10 or a dozen, everyone included. They have program offices in many of the countries where they work, and probably about half a dozen offices.
And we've been talking about developing economies tonight. Have they any traction in the rich world?
That's not their mission. I mean, my experience here in Britain, where I'm based, is that there is, of course, significant corporate lobbying on tax issues. But certainly in the industry I specialise in, which is oil, to a very large extent, there's already ideological agreement between our government and the major oil companies, and actually, you know, I'd probably go further and say strategic partnership. So there have been times when they've launched heavy lobbying efforts to cut tax, but there is a reason why Britain has one of the lowest oil tax rates in the world, and that's because the British government and the oil companies are intimately linked.
John Christensen, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now. John, have you ever come in contact with the International Tax and Investment Centre?
I haven't come into direct contact with them, no. But I have come into contact with similar organisations and similar individuals doing similar things in different contexts. So, for example, working in both Algeria and Nigeria, I've come across sometimes academic economists claiming to work separately and completely individually, doing similar things, and very often you'll find that they are sponsored either by the oil corporations directly or by some of the big accounting firms which act on behalf of oil corporations. In one case in particular, in Zambia, 5 years ago, an academic was doing exactly the same thing in the Zambian context, saying, look, you know, you need to attract more inward investment. You need to create a competitive tax environment. So he managed to persuade them to give 10-year tax holidays, to lower the tax rates, to lower the royalty rates, to the point where there was a virtual collapse of revenues from copper mining in Zambia. So there is a pattern at play here, and it's a pattern which very often involves so-called professionals. Actually, they are lobbyists masquerading as professionals, acting on behalf of very powerful multinational corporations. And I'm talking here about companies like KPMG, Ernst & Young, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and they talk in terms of advice, but it's advice which is couched in very strong terms. You know, you must create a modern tax regime. And a modern tax regime, as far as they're concerned, is a tax regime where their clients pay as little as possible. They talk about tax efficiency. Well, tax efficiency is one of those glib terms which, when you analyze it, tax efficiency means that rich people who can afford to pay very high fees to create international structures for minimizing tax and can tax plan around those structures, they end up paying very little tax or no tax at all in some cases. whereas the rest of us, ordinary people, end up having to pay more or to accept cuts in public services. So all the time we're seeing lobbying organizations like ITIC, and in some cases they are very highly placed, very high profile international organizations, as I said, the big four accounting firms, who are doing this on a constant basis. They're talking to journalists all the time, and they're always pushing this idea about tax efficiency. Tax cuts are a good thing. If we give this tax concession, we'll attract more investment into this industry. Well, research done in the United States by colleagues of mine now demonstrates that in most cases, these tax concessions, these tax incentives, create no new jobs at all and bring no new wealth at all.
And I can imagine that similar groups would be set up surrounding other types of industries. I'm thinking pharmaceuticals, I'm thinking banking. Have you come across any of those types of industries in your research, Greg?
We focus specifically on oil. There are lots of cases where this has happened, but if I could just pick up on a point that John made, which is that these people masquerade as professionals, and time and again, what I've seen, in particular the Iraqi government being forced to accept, the word that's used to describe it is advice. It's always advice, whether they're academics. In the case of the International Tax and Investment Center, it's actually a charity. It calls itself an education foundation.
You're joking.
No, seriously. All its money comes from major multinational companies. It was funded specifically by six oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, Shell, BP, and a couple of others, to do this work, pushing for their interests in Iraq.
And this,
it's called advice.
And if I could just butt in there just for a moment, the significance of that financially for them is that then they don't have to pay tax on that, that that would be money given to a charity that would be tax deductible.
Yeah, that's why they do it, or one of the reasons they do it. And the way it talks about it is, we're providing advice to the Iraqis on how to develop a successful modern economy. Now, if you put that in the Iraqi context, and think about what we normally mean by the word advice, if you give me some advice, I can make a choice of whether I take that advice or ignore it. But in the context of Iraq, the actual handing over of the lobbying document that ITIC produced, that was done not by the oil companies, not by ITIC, but by the British ambassador to Iraq. He formally presented their lobbying document to the finance minister. Now, when you bear in mind that the finance minister will have been very aware that the ambassador had, at the time, about 9,000 troops standing behind him, that kind offer of advice is an offer that's difficult to refuse.
Absolutely. Greg and John, you've both just contributed to a recent publication, just released in fact, A Game as Old as the Empire. In terms of the issue that we're talking about tonight, tax, what was the feature in that book that most surprised you? Can I ask you first, John?
I think the book is shocking because of the overall picture it paints. When you read the book, you see a pattern here, and it's global. And it seems to run right the way through the professions. What really struck me is how privileged, educated, highly paid elites around the world have been not just assisting with corruption around the world, they've been profiting from corruption around the world, and yet they present themselves as independent, professional people doing a professional job. And I think it's time that we actually expose these people for what they are. They are professional charlatans and they're crooks. And it's not just accountants, it's lawyers, it's economic advisors, it's bankers and so on. It runs right the way through some of the elite professions.
What about you, Greg?
Like John, I was especially struck by the common patterns, the systemic nature of the way this works, in particular the vast amount of resources and the huge number of people that work on representing the interests of the world's wealthiest corporations. One of the things that was really interesting about the book was that it actually looked at some of the characters involved in this. You know, we often tend to think of these things in terms of economic systems or laws and other abstractions, but actually there are people, there are men and women, well, mostly men, who are actually involved in pushing these things. One of the things that really came across in the book is the sheer disconnect between the lifestyles of these, quotes, advisors and those of the people around them who are really affected by their, quotes, advice. These people, they'll fly out to a country, they'll stay in five-star hotels, they'll have, you know, incredible dinners with the ministers, and they will have no connection with the real people who are very often living in extreme poverty and who they claim to be helping. there's basically two different worlds on either side of an issue that they're pushing.
That was Greg Muttis from Platform, an organisation that does some amazing work on difficult issues such as oil and gas extraction by presenting research, analysis through writing and performance. Before you go, Greg, what do you think is the value of performance in getting across the political messages that Platform is trying to make?
Well, Platform does use cultural and artistic strategies such as performance to communicate on these issues. I'm not an artist by background, I'm an activist and a researcher, but the reason I started working at Platform is because I went to a couple of Platform performances, and what I found was that those performances communicated with me in a completely different way from how I react to, say, a report or a book or a newspaper article or a speech. The engagement with it was much more intimate and much more personal, and I think that's incredibly powerful. Rather than just informing, it does inform people, but it goes much beyond that, and it encourages people to become personally and emotionally committed to an issue. That's very powerful. We live in an information-heavy world, and we need to explore new ways of communicating with people.
Thanks very much, Greg, for being with us tonight. Great to talk to you.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Okay, well, that's it from today's Radio New Internationalist. Thanks, as always, to this program's associate producer, Rachel Maher. And thanks, too, to this program's co-host, John Christensen, who's guided us so easily through some quite difficult financial terrains. As we mentioned at the beginning of today's program, this broadcast has just won an Australian Media Award, the 2007 Excellence in Spoken Word Programming Award from the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. While the program was broadcast late last August, everything in it is, I'm sorry to say, just as relevant today. My guess is that we'll be hearing much more about these issues in the next New Year's, so stay tuned. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. With money bouncing across borders throughout today's program, today's CD is called Rumba Without Borders, Rumba Sin Fronteras, performed by Cuban percussionist Pancho Quinto, together with a long list of his Havana friends. It's a collaboration spanning a number of generations, creating new frontiers in Afro-Cuban beats. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find copies of this program just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. I'm Chris Richards. Speak to you soon.